As your company scales, the hardest part isn't ambition, it's alignment. That's why Atlassian built the Teamwork Collection, an AI-powered teamwork platform designed to help teams move faster together. By connecting Jira, Confluence, Loom, and Rovo, teams can easily align work to real business goals, plan and track progress together, remove knowledge silos, and access the real magic of AI plus human collaboration. Visit Atlassian.com/teamchanger to learn more. That's Atlassian.com/teamchanger. On Masters of Scale, we talk a lot about inflection points, those moments when a technology stops being optional and starts being fundamental. AI presents one of those moments, and behind every breakthrough, whether it's medical research or education or even cinematic visual effects, there's infrastructure most people never see. As the essential cloud for AI, CoreWeave is building that foundation. It provides a purpose-built AI cloud designed specifically for pioneers at leading AI labs and enterprises, ready to power the biggest ideas and the boldest ambitions. Ready for anything, ready for AI. To learn more about how CoreWeave powers the world's best AI, go to coreweave.com/readyforanything.
Startups grow in unpredictable ways, but your infrastructure shouldn't. Deel scales with you from employee one to employee 1,000. Deel's real-time payroll engine cuts weeks-long cycles down to minutes, and their global experts keep you compliant as you expand. Plus, startups can tap into perks like up to $25,000 in Deel credits and support programs designed specifically for high-growth teams. Deel is the fastest way to hire, manage, pay, and equip anyone, anywhere. Deel, your forever people platform. Visit deel.com/MOS to learn more and book a demo.
Suddenly, you know, we can't criticize the government, right? Because there will be a tremendous backlash. And, you know, that's really sad. You know, you could talk about whether CEOs speaking up on an issue, whether that's a good idea or not. But the idea that they wouldn't dare in this climate because it's too scary, you know, that's China under the Communist Party. I mean, that's somehow an unintended consequence of where we are right now.
That's Adi Ignatius, longtime editor-in-chief of Harvard Business Review. After 16 years at the helm, Adi recently passed the mantle, but today's episode is much more than an exit interview. It is an eye-opening strategic examination of today's unprecedented business climate, from AI's impact to Elon Musk to the evolving role of what it means to be a business leader. Adi is refreshingly candid, sharing lessons and unfiltered assessments. I think it's one of the most important, insightful episodes we've done, so let's get to it. I'm Bob Safian, and this is Rapid Response. I'm Bob Safian. I'm here with Adi Ignatius, the longtime editor-in-chief of Harvard Business Review and an old colleague and friend. Adi, great, as always, to chat with you.
Nice to be on with you. Thanks for doing this.
You and I first worked together at Time Magazine as executive editors. You have then ran HBR for more than 15 years before turning over the reins to Amy Bernstein earlier this year. Is it a bittersweet moment passing the mantle, or are you content? I know I had mixed feelings about leaving Fast Company.
So yes and no. I mean, it's nice to be editor-in-chief. I reached a point in my career, though, where I didn't want to have direct reports. I didn't want to be sitting in meetings with the board. You know, I realized what I needed at this moment in my life was to get back to the reason we all got into this profession in the first place, to write, to report, to create content. So I definitely have a pep in my step. And yes, I miss some of the trappings of power, but I'm really happy with the shift.
You've covered so many seminal, like tumultuous moments, wars, 9/11, market collapses, regime changes. 2025, the current climate, it feels like we're at a threshold, even though it's not quite cataclysmic. Do you have a thought, a feeling about what we've seen so far in 2025?
So there are some indexes that tracked fear, that track fear, you know, and the fear index has been kind of off the charts in ways that it had only been during the kind of early peak of COVID and during the financial collapse of 2008. So, you know, to the extent we can measure something, yeah, we're in a strange moment. I don't mean to make a, you know, much of a plug for HBR, but, you know, we've just launched a new product called HBR Executive, which is very much leaning into the fact that this, you know, it's always hard at the top, but this is a really difficult moment to lead, partly because AI is out there and it's going to disrupt us all. And we're not sure when, and we're not sure how or how much, but it will. So that huge uncertainty there. And then so maybe what you're hinting at, the kind of political and geopolitical uncertainty that is just off the charts and really makes it difficult. So our point is, you know, not just to say it's uncertain out there, folks, but to say it's uncertain out there and there's things we've never seen before, but we have lived through moments in the past of enormous uncertainty and there are ways to lead through it. And we will try to share some of those best practices.
Do you have a framework or a philosophy about how you personally think about change?
So if there are two big uncertainties now, and let's say technology, but especially AI, and then the geopolitics, I think with AI, you know, I'm not an expert on anything, but I talk to a lot of people and, you know, Kareem Lakhani at HBS, who's really an expert on AI, generative AI in the workplace. I mean, his big thought is that CEOs are talking about AI all the time. They're talking to their boards. They're talking to their shareholders. They're sounding knowledgeable. And he says, in fact, they're not. They're not. Most CEOs are not even remotely knowledgeable. And that it's really important that they get that threshold of kind of competence and understanding. Because, you know, if you're in the camp that thinks AI is truly going to change everything, and I am until proven otherwise, you know, then the transformation needs to be driven from the top. So it needs to be understood, you know, from the top. So the technological part is you've got to get involved and it has to be CEO driven. With politics and geopolitics, I mean, you know, in a sense, you have to have your own foreign policy, right? Every company needs to really pay attention and think there's so much baloney coming out of Washington, but then some of it sticks, right? Some of it is not bluster, but is actually significant. So I think, you know, having either connecting with people who know or having people on your team who really know and know how to kind of tease out what's real versus what's not real, what you need to panic about, what you don't need to panic about is really essential. So you can't just sit back and try to follow the news cycle because the news cycles are insane, right? And not helpful. So I think those are a couple things, a couple ways to think about it. I mean, there's a lot of scenario planning. I talked to a Brazilian CEO today, right? So they're suddenly threatened with, you know, enormous levels of tariffs that are purely personal. Brazil has a trade deficit with the U.S., and yet, you know, Trump is threatening them with enormous tariffs. It's purely personal, political. You know, he doesn't like Lula, and he liked Bolsonaro, and he's trying to kind of manipulate Brazilian politics and how its Supreme Court works. So, you know, what do you do with that? So this CEO, they are doing a bunch of scenario planning. If tariffs come in at 50%, if they come in at half that, if they come in at 10%, and they're not sure what else to do because it is just enormously uncertain.
Well, and I guess all these institutions have to develop the capacity to be more flexible than maybe they've needed to be before because things are so unstable, right? Which I guess AI maybe provides an opportunity to do if you can get your organization to handle it the right way.
I guess. you know, we live through a period. I mean, it's not like this is the worst time in the history of the world. It's definitely not. There have been periods that were, you know, much more uncertain because there was, you know, broader global war, et cetera. Okay. But we had a kind of, you know, post-World War II order and predictability that obviously had winners and losers, and there were, you know, terrible tragedies along the way. But, you know, there was a basic, I don't know, rules-based order, at least, you know, in the West, and you kind of knew what to expect. So now you don't, and the U.S. has a president that doesn't like rules-based order. So you've lost a certain reliability or dependability on what America, the world's most powerful country, stands for. and will be advocating for. So it's tough. It's slippery. And you know, I know the knee-jerk thing is to say, well, China's the big winner. And I think it's important to really analyze that. But I think it's possible China's the big winner as the, you know, kind of global economy and global, you know, trade protocol is restructured. I think a lot of this could be to China's benefit.
For our listeners' benefit, you spent a fair amount of time in China. You were Wall Street Journal bureau chief in Beijing. You ran Time Asia. You're also bureau chief in Moscow. So you've been in, inside some of these places that people are trying to figure out right now. Are there ways that you think people understand or misunderstand what's going on in China, what's going on in Russia, and what the impact is going to be on us?
So Americans, I think, by and large, misunderstand China. Americans, by and large, are not comfortable with the repressions that exist in China with a sort of strongman government. And, you know, that's all fine. China is booming. I mean, you know, you go to a Chinese city and it is, you feel, wow, I'm in the future and America is not in the future, right? I think there's some people who associate the repression in China with a sense that people are listless and want to overthrow their government or unhappy. And it couldn't be farther from the truth. I mean, you know, China is booming. You know, if you think about where the U.S. is moving away from sort of cleaner fuels, you know, China has its you know, foot on the accelerator. I mean, it is really dynamic, not just big cities, big buildings, but, you know, developing a kind of the future economy. And we're still in the sort of fossil fuels past. So, so I think there's a general misunderstanding just how rich and developed and dynamic China is, even though it has enormous problems, including unemployment, including, you know, fiscal issues. I mean, it's certainly not perfect, but I think that's a misunderstanding. Russia, I mean, God, Russia has squandered opportunities to develop its economy since the fall of the Soviet Union. I mean, really, you know, has so many resources and the ability to be an economic player, and instead has just fallen victim to corruption and sort of stupid wars. I think that's pretty well understood.
You posted something early this year around the time of the World Economic Forum about Davos Man as compared to what you called Mar-a-Lago Man. Do you remember this?
Yeah. So I was trying to capture, and Bob, you think about this stuff all the time, you know, so there was, let's say there was 50 years of kind of Milton Friedman sort of dominated philosophy to management, and basically, you know, shareholders are what matter, and you could just measure that, and if managers are also aligned to benefit, if the share price goes up, then that's great. Then your shareholders and your managers are aligned, and you know the other stuff will fall into place. And then, you know, 10 years ago, whatever, suddenly people got more serious talking about stakeholders more broadly. That it's not enough to worry about share price. You have to think about your employees and your customers and sustainability, the planet. And that seemed pretty entrenched, although I'd say the world was searching for the kind of theory, right, that was as simple or as easy to grasp as a sort of Friedman-esque focus on the share price. HBR, we wrote lots about stakeholder capitalism and you know, it kind of became, that's what they were teaching at Harvard Business School, and that's what everybody in Davos was talking about. You know, you need to worry more about your bottom than just about your bottom line, the share price. And then Trump got elected. So that's why I wrote this piece on Davos Man. And this is defining Davos Man as, you know, elite businessmen, but who also gets, you know, whatever. They're listening to their kids or whatever outside pressure, but they understand, you know, they have to think about the externalities they're creating. They have to think about the planet. They have to think about some social issues and not just the bottom line. And then Mar-a-Lago Man, you know, is now in ascendance. And, you know, in some ways, I Mark Andreessen gave an interview, I think to the New York Times, that it's worth reading because he's just really articulate in speaking about kind of this new wave, you know, sort of like Mark Zuckerberg saying, you know, more masculine energy. And, you know, so Andreessen just says things like, why would I want people to bring their whole selves to work? Like, why is that good? And that's been such a for a decade, we've been saying, you want your employees engaged, let them bring their whole selves to work. So that's being questioned. So the point of the article I wrote is that to the extent to which, like, you should have values as a company that don't flip-flop with every election, right? You should figure out what they are, and then you stick to them, hell or high water. And if it's just performative, then, okay, get rid of them. You know, that's fine. But you have to figure out what your values are, and they cannot just be, you know, subject to every twist in the political calculation.
No, and I think we have seen that, because the pressure Trump is putting on leaders to, like, you're either committed to this or you're going to go away, whether it's, you know, DEI or, you know, whatever, immigration policy or something else, right? Like, what do you really believe in? That is what did Ken Frazier, the former Merck CEO, said to me. You know, their principles and then their preferences, right? And if you're not going to pay a little cost for something, then it's really just a preference, and don't turn it into a principle if it's not something, you know, you're willing to have it cost you a little bit.
Yeah, no, that's well put. And look, I feel for CEOs now who don't want to be in the crosshairs of this administration, because they could make life difficult for you, as they could make life difficult for politicians who stand in their way. But, you know, I mean, there is a search for an alternative. I mean, I talked to a Silicon Valley CEO recently who, you know, in Silicon Valley, you know, CEOs there don't have the same political beliefs. There's certainly a strong libertarian strain there. But this was a guy who said, you have to understand, we were deep blue. Right. This is this CEO and his cohorts, right? In the tech world. We were deep blue. And then they, you know, they got pissed off with regulation and, you know, didn't like Biden's appointments and thought Biden was unfriendly to business and to mergers and things like that. Okay, fine. You know, that's a perception. And he said, we became deep red, and we were excited about Trump. We were excited that Musk was going to be doing the Doge thing. We were excited about, you know, Lutnick and trade. Like, we were excited. And then the administration began, and there was this, you know, incredible uncertainty with all this tariff stuff that just made it hard to lead a business. And then more than that, the immigration thing, it made it really difficult to bring engineers in, you know, even from, forget China, but from India. So, you know, these are guys who flipped deep blue to deep red and are now having buyer's remorse. And, you know, the extent to which, I think, you know, whoever wins the next election will have to have a platform that is somehow appealing to business. You know, I mean, you know, the Biden administration, I mean, there were parts of it that almost seemed cartoonishly anti-business. You know, they're bad and rapacious. And, you know, I believe in regulation, of course, but, you know, I there has to be a middle ground. You cannot lose business and hope to prevail, I think, in this country.
You mentioned this, that sort of a lot of business leaders just sort of kind of want to keep their heads down right now. Do CEOs wish they could be more outspoken, or, you know, is speaking out like bravery, or is it just like foolishness at this point?
I love this topic because, you know, if you go back a generation, you know, CEOs didn't talk publicly about political issues and social issues. Like, why would they? You know, that would be crazy. And then with the rise of the internet, there was this sort of truism, and I feel like I said it many times, that CEOs don't have the option of not speaking, right? Because,
yes,
you know, their employees want to know where they stand on these important social and political issues. Their customers want to know. If you decide, I'm just going to stay silent, the internet, you know, X, will interpret your silence however it wants to, and it might be negative. So you have no choice. You have to jump in to the fray. And we wrote articles, and I've said that was sort of the new reality. Well, maybe not, right? Target's problems, Bud Light. I mean, there were attempts to get involved in social issues that really backfired, that made I think companies think twice about what they're doing. I guess where we've landed is that, again, you know, figure out what your real values are, and if there are issues that really touch your business directly, or your, you know, I don't know, the values that you stand for, then yes, you cannot be silent. But this idea that you have to weigh in or your employees will get mad, I think we've rethought that.
part of what appealed to me about your framing of Davos man versus Mar-a-Lago man. Like, Davos man is sort of CEO as statesman in a lot of ways, right? And right now, sort of
yep.
CEOs and business leaders are a little bit like, I don't know whether I want to be a statesman, but not if I have to deal with some of the garbage that goes with being a statesman.
I feel like the United States sort of overnight became China, right? Where, you know, you have this tremendous ability to do what you want as a business, but suddenly, you know, we can't criticize the government, right?
Yeah.
Because there will be a tremendous backlash and I might lose my, you know, that's China. That's authoritarianism. And I'm not saying anybody has stated that as a policy, but that's how it's rippling through. And, you know, that's really sad. You know, you could talk about whether CEOs speaking up on an issue, whether that's a good idea or not, or whether their statements are good or not. But the idea that they wouldn't dare in this climate because it's too scary, you know, that's China under the Communist Party. I mean, that's somehow an unintended consequence of where we are right now.
Adi doesn't mince his words. Some CEOs I've spoken to are relieved that there's less pressure to speak out on things that, frankly, they weren't particularly comfortable speaking on in the first place. On the other hand, other CEOs are mourning the loss of exercising their pulpit. As with much of what Adi and I discuss about 2025, it's an evolution that could progress or regress from here. So what signals does Adi keep his eyes on? And how does he feel about Trump's attack on Harvard, where HBR is, of course, based? We'll talk about that, Elon Musk, and Adi's most important leadership lessons after the break. Stay with us.
Hey, folks, Jeff Berman here. Exciting news. Applications are now open for the Masters of Scale Summit. It's happening October 20th through October 22nd in San Francisco, and it is a really special event. Please join our curated community of founders, innovators, and leaders shaping the future. Expect ideas that challenge your assumptions and connections that move your business and maybe even your life forward. It's an experience that can change literally everything. Apply now at mastersofscale.com/apply26. That's mastersofscale.com/apply26.
While everyone was debating whether or not Bitcoin was an asset for their portfolio, CoinShares was quietly building the foundation to invest in it properly. CoinShares launched the world's first Bitcoin ETP back in 2015. Today, they manage nearly $6 billion and are profitable through multiple market cycles. CoinShares is publicly traded on NASDAQ Stockholm and announced in September it is seeking a U.S. listing. CoinShares is the one-stop shop for digital asset investment, passive ETFs, active strategies, and mining exposure. Every approach built to institutional standards. CoinShares. The adults have arrived. Learn more at CoinShares.com. This is Zeb Farbman, co-founder and CEO of Lightrix, a technology company that creates AI-powered video models and tools.
Most of our research was along the border between computer graphics and image processing, and we thought that if we pair our expertise with this new platform, we will be able to create new tools and new creative experiences that no one did before.
But when the generative AI boom disrupted everything, Lightrix seized the moment with a new burst of innovation. They created LTX2, an open-source AI model enabling its users to generate high-quality video content, giving them full creative control from concept to delivery on one platform.
I think a lot of the values that we took from academia reflect how we are thinking about our models. We want them to be open. We want a collaborative environment. And we really, really care about efficiency. We always believe deep research is the key to unlocking a competitive advantage and building cool things. It's even more important during the age of AI.
Start creating today with LTX2 at ltx.studio.
Before the break, Adi Ignatius of the Harvard Business Review shared what Americans most misunderstand about China, why business leaders aren't speaking out against Trump, and more. Now we dig into AI, Elon Musk, and Harvard's response to Trump's attacks. Let's jump back in. I have to ask you about Harvard's battle with the Trump administration. I mean, you work at Harvard, of course. What's the feeling at the institution?
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for Harvard. I'm not involved in any of these conversations. There's soul searching at Harvard, certainly. I mean, if there are charges of let's say anti-Semitism coming from anywhere, you have to take that seriously and not dismiss that and figure out, all right, you know, have we created a climate for that? And if so, how do we respond? And, you know, any intelligent institution would take that seriously and figure out what to do. As a layperson, it seems like this is more personal and vindictive than fact-based. That for a, you know, a kind of, from a MAGA perspective, Harvard is the enemy, a bunch of mostly liberal experts telling people what to do. Harvard's always been a target. I mean, you know, you look at clickbait in any, you know, news thing, and if it's somebody, you know, taking down Harvard or Harvard makes a mistake, I mean, you know, the world loves to read about that because it's just, it's a symbol of greatness or liberalness or both. And so if they slip up, it's a target. So I will say, having talked to a lot of Harvard alumni, it's not universal, but by and large, and almost everyone I've talked to is really impressed with Alan Garber and with Harvard's response. When the charges of, okay, Harvard is anti-Semitic came out, there were people who canceled their subscriptions to Harvard Business Review saying, look, I don't want to give money to any publication that's linked to a, you know, quote unquote, anti-Semitic organization. So that was an initial backlash. You know, now it's very different. If you don't like what Trump is doing, or if you think he has too much power, it's, you know, it's king-like, and that's, we're supposed to have a separation of powers. It's like, well, who will stand up? And the lawyers won't stand up. And, you know, companies we've already talked about are too intimidated to kind of respond. And so, okay, you know, Harvard's not caving. Harvard's, and who knows where it goes if it ends up as a positive thing or a negative thing. But I do find a lot of outside support for that.
If Harvard's not going to stand up to the president, you know, what other academic institution would, right?
Yeah. And look, I heard somebody at UCLA just saying, good for Harvard. We couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. You know, they can't even pretend they could do that just with their dependence on federal money to sort of function as an institution. I mean, it's crazy taking away the grant money for Harvard. I mean, you know, these are grants to solve problems that America has that the government cannot do. So to take away that funding, it doesn't hurt Harvard exactly. Yeah, it hurts Harvard, but this is meant to be health research or other research that like America needs, American citizens need. You're hurting America. I mean, it's just, there's something truly insane about this particular battle. Again, speaking as a layperson and not as an insider. And, you know, I think there are few institutions who could imagine standing up, and that might depend on, the big endowment that they have that enables them maybe to survive these kind of shocks.
The other king in America, I guess, or potential king, it seemed to be Elon Musk, right? The other guy who seems like he can do whatever he wants with almost no repercussions. Although I don't know whether the departure of ex-CEO Lindy Iacarino means anything related to, you know, whatever Grok's anti-Semitic exchanges. It's so hard to follow even with Musk, sort of what's going on, his new political foray. He seems to be in the news every bit as much as Trump. Do you have a perspective on Musk?
I mean, I think Musk has been chasing. I mean, I think he's realized his foray into politics has cost him at Tesla, certainly. You know, the damage the business is facing is pretty directly related to some of the perception of sort of what he's doing, that was bad for his business. I don't know why he then came back and said, I'm going to form another political party, you know, because I think that the polls I've seen, it seems to be contributing to a sort of negative take on him and on his business. So Even when he took over Twitter, right? I mean, it seemed more like he was trolling himself, maybe. I mean, you know, he sort of enjoys playing the role of the troll. It seems like more than running a business, more than doing Doge. I mean, you know, that seems to be really sort of fundamental to his identity. So even though I think he's been chasing and he's got a board saying, can you pay a little attention to our business over here? I think he sort of seems incorrigible or just seems to have this desire to kind of jump in the most public ways possible. I mean, he's addicted, it seems like, to, you know, his ex following and his ability to kind of troll and get a reaction.
I mean, it's interesting too for me, because as a business leader, I think he was, you know, and has been admired and, you know, extolled about his sort of his vision as a business leader and what he's built and what he sees. And this foray into the government work has sort of, it's undercut some of that too.
So I think about, should HBR interview Donald Trump? Should HBR interview Elon Musk? You know, with Donald Trump, we've decided not to pursue that. And that's a tricky one. I mean, he is the president of the United States, and the president of the United States should presumably have interesting things to say about the economy and about business that would be valuable to readers. But, you know, those interviews go off the rails, right? And you're tempted to kind of fact check him and correct him and try to demand that he answer the question, that he stay on topic, and none of that will happen. So you could end up with a very combative interview. And do I want to do that? Does Harvard Business Review want to do that? It might yield headlines, especially if it got sort of chippy, but would it yield any insight? So we've declined. If Musk agreed to do an interview, I would do that. Cause I think he has some of the same tendencies to sort of, you know, blow up an interview and, but as you say, I mean, he legitimately has been a kind of amazing business person, right? He's created or sustained, however you want to look at it, you know, some really game changing businesses. I'd like to know what's in his brain about what's next in business. I don't care what he thinks is next in politics. And I think he thinks we all care about that.
You know, I was looking, you recently wrote a cautionary article about AI and privacy. Are you an AI advocate or more on the concern side?
If it's a binary choice, I guess I'm an advocate more than we must stop this because of the unintended consequences. I mean, you just listen to the experts and kind of, you know, put your finger in the wind and decide, okay, the metaverse, I kind of bought into that for a while, but then I realized, nah, that's not a big deal. This one, I think, is. And who knows, right? I mean, you know, we're not experts. And even the experts obviously don't know how AI will evolve or how, you know, consumer preferences will evolve. But my expectation is we will adopt AI at an enormous scale. Hopefully, you know, it doesn't drive unemployment to scary levels, but it could. I mean, you know, I think that's a possibility. So, HBR, we're a content creator. I'm angry that all these large language models felt they could just sort of steal our content and then ask for forgiveness, or not even just sort of say, well, it's different. We're not really, you know, that's crazy. I mean, but I, you know, if you're not using AI in your work and life, it's like, start doing it. It's not perfect. It's not a fact generating machine, right? There are, you know, flaws, but the, you know, ability of this technology to do incredible things is here, and I think we'll get better. So, I guess that makes me an advocate or proponent or somebody who's in awe at the very least.
And those of us in the media and news business, like the state of journalism, the state of the news business. I mean, it's in flux, right? Because the ways we've been, I don't know, compensated for the work that is fueling these large language models is under pressure.
People use the phrase Google Zero now, right? I mean, we got most of our traffic from Google searches. And now Google, especially with AI, you know, it wants to give you an answer and that's it. And even if Google provides links, I'm not sure any user wants to follow a link right now, right? You know, sort of the expectation of how you retrieve information and get quick answers and insight has just sort of changed. So, you know, our traffic from Google has just shrunk. Same with every other media company. And it's not crazy to talk about Google Zero, where we're getting, you know, zero referrals from Google, which, you know, they don't owe that to us, but that was, you know, the main source of web traffic for a lot of us. So, you know, I would say for us and for other media companies, you know, we're trying to create new products like the one I mentioned, HBR Executive, and driving new business. But I think longer term, I think we all realize the old model doesn't hold. We have to figure out how to thrive in a world where AI can do a lot of what we do, where it has, you know, so what does HBR do? We're trying to give people really smart research-based advice on their careers and on, you know, business challenges. And, you know, AI, partly because it scraped all of our content, could do that pretty well. So we have to figure out, okay, so pretty well is pretty well, you know, we can do things better. What does better mean in an AI world? You know, marginally better, probably people won't pay for that. Significantly better, more reliable, that involves more, you know, human interaction and contact, you know, that's the answer is probably there. So we have to know what AI can do and what parts of our business it could, you know, fully disrupt, and then figure out how to pivot from there.
I've noticed an irony that in an era where, let's say, some of the places that you and I may have worked may be referred to as fake news, so that the trust of what journalism does, you know, has gone down, but you get that same source scraped and emerged to it as a large language model, and there it's trusted. Right? Like, it's fake news if it comes from the New York Times, but if it comes from, you know, ChatGPT, you know, that's true.
Well, that's interesting. So do you think people have that relationship to ChatGPT, where if they read it on ChatGPT, they think, I can trust this?
I think younger people do. In the same way that I think people trusted that Google search pointed you to the right places, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you didn't question it.
So let me take you like up to 30,000 feet. You're 16 years of running HBR. Like, are there lessons that you find yourself coming back to from this experience? Are there things that you think people most misunderstand about business, or, you know, mistakes that you see business people making over and over again? Like, what do you find yourself anchoring on?
I think leadership is real. You know, I do think, you know, companies can succeed or founder depending on the quality of leadership, and that it's not simply genetic, you know, you're charismatic or you're smart or you're not, that you can learn. You can learn to listen. You can learn to manage your time in ways that take advantage of what you need to do versus what anybody can do. I do believe in that there is there's an ability to you know, hone your skills as a leader, and you know, and whether it's from, you know, an aphorism from Jack Welch or a, you know, a 12-page piece, you know, that has a framework for that. That there are ways to learn and really improve your game. So I do believe in that. You know, the search for the kind of purpose of business, you know, what we were talking about before, where, you know, for 50 years, it was all about the share price. I think we need a new sort of consensus of the new paradigm. And it, you know, it may be that the stakeholder stuff was too fuzzy or unclear. I won't say woke, because I don't think that's a helpful word ever. But is there a theory of the case that we can all agree on, that what is the responsibility of a company, of a CEO? And I guess the one other thing is that, you know, the soft skills, you know, how do you interact with people? I mean, the things that seem sort of basic, they really matter, and they matter kind of up and down the hierarchy, you know, from the CEO down to the lowest level. Business is how people interact with one another. So, I came to understand that stuff is really important.
Are you still feeling optimistic about the future? Are you more optimistic, more anxious, or are you somewhere in between?
Yeah, that's a good question for everybody right now. So I find myself giving in to this tendency to sort of bury my head in the sand, you know, where the barrage of political news is just too much. One result of that is my tennis game has gotten a lot better. I mean, I'm not going to hide it. I'm a relatively liberal guy who is, you know, kind of shocked and amazed by what is happening in this country right now. And, I believe in the resilience of the American system. I don't think it's automatic, though. You know, you can't just say, well, we've been resilient for 250 years, so we'll be fine. No, I mean, I think at a certain level, all of us have to fight in our own way for what we believe in. I certainly don't believe that progress is inevitable. I mean, you know, there is a New Yorker cartoon to be done that basically shows the world blowing up and somehow a couple scientists who have survived are saying, but we were making so much progress, right? I mean, I think, you know, progress, you know, might be illusory in some ways, but, you know, I mean, Bob, the generation we've grown in has been, you know, in many ways, the rise of business around the world, the lifting of standards of living and life expectancy. I mean, you can't help but look at some of those things and think, okay, there is a positive trend, even if there are a lot of potholes along the way.
I guess all we can say is let's hope so.
Yeah, that's the best we could do.
Well, Adi, this was great.
Thank you, Bob.
I always appreciate the time I have with Adi to talk about journalism, but also for his perspective on business and what it takes to be a leader. I agree with Adi that it feels like we're on a slippery slope these days, as many U.S. institutions capitulate to government demands that until recently seemed unthinkable. I also agree that it's tricky to know what impact an individual business or executive can have in this environment. But I also think that if we're going to find a new paradigm in business, as Adi puts it, about the responsibility of a company and a CEO beyond just the stock price, that it's going to start by standing up for shared values and principles. I'm Bob Safian. Thanks for listening.
AI breakthroughs are quickly reshaping every industry around the world. Healthcare, education, science, entertainment, and beyond. But true global scale only happens when the underlying infrastructure can maintain pace with the rapid speed of innovation. As the essential cloud for AI, CoreWeave is a purpose-built cloud made for the real demands of today's most complex AI models, bringing the pace, performance, and partnership leading pioneers need to continue pushing boundaries. Ready for anything? Ready for AI. To learn more about how CoreWeave powers the world's best AI, go to coreweave.com/ready for anything. Hey folks, if you enjoyed our recent episode with my friend Matt Abrahams, the brilliant author and academic has his own podcast, Think Fast, Talk Smart. Twice a week, the Stanford lecturer sits down with experts to discuss their best advice to hone and develop your communication skills. Learn to stress less about public speaking, make more meaningful small talk, and much more. You'll always get science-backed strategies and actionable tips you can use right away. And Matt is just a fantastic guy. You're going to love having him in your ear. Listen to Think Fast, Talk Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm PJ Vogt. My podcast, Search Engine, has a new two-part series for you. Of all the new technologies coming out of AI, the most transformative one might be driverless cars. They're already on the road in 10 American cities, and they're quickly coming to more. We tell the story of how we got here. The secret team at Google that spent 15 years building what might be the safest vehicle on the road, and we cover the fights brewing in blue cities, where unions and politicians are working to keep those cars off the streets. Listen to Search Engine wherever you get your podcasts.
Rapid Response is a Wait What original. I'm Bob Safian. Our executive producer is Eve Troe. Our producer is Alex Morris. Associate producer is Mashumaku Tonina. Mixing and mastering
by Aaron Bastinelli. Our theme music is by Ryan Holiday. Our head of podcasts is Lital Malad. For more, visit rapidresponseshow.com.